I lift the lid on my desk to block out Anne's face. No, of course not. Don't be silly. But for the first time, I see the hint of a smile, a real smile, tugging at the corners of her mouth. Will they never get tired of that one? She mutters, shaking her head. Before I can respond, Mademoiselle Lafarge, all 200 pounds of her, sweeps into the room with a cheery, Bonjour! She grabs a rag and rubs it vigorously across the already clean slate, prattling on in French the whole time, stopping to ask the occasional question, which, I'm panicked to discover, everyone has the answers to, in French. I haven't the faintest idea what's going on, French being a language I've always thought sounded vaguely like gargling. Mademoiselle Lafarge stops at my desk, claps her hands together in discovery. Ah, une nouvelle fille! Comment vous appelez-vous? Her face hovers dangerously near mine so that I can see the space between her two front teeth and every pore on her wide nose. Beg your pardon, I ask. She wags a chubby finger. Non, non, non. En français, s'il vous plaît. Maintenant, comment vous appelez-vous? She gives me that hopeful, wide smile again. Behind me, I hear snickering erupt from Felicity and Pippa. The first day of my new life, and I'm stumped before I begin. It feels like hours before Anne finally volunteers a helpful, Elle s'appelle Gemma. What is your name? All those strangled vowel sounds to ask one bloody stupid question. This is the silliest language on earth. Ah, bon, Anne, très bon. Felicity is still stifling her laughter. Mademoiselle Lafarge asks her a question. I pray she'll stumble through it like a cow, but her French is absolutely flawless. There is no justice in the world. Each time Mademoiselle Lafarge asks me something, I stare straight ahead and say pardon a lot, as if being either deaf or polite will help me understand this impossible language. Her wide grin closes slowly into a scowl till she gives up asking me anything altogether, which is fine with me. When the grueling hour is finally over, I have learned to stumble my way through the phrases, how charming, and yes, my strawberries are very juicy. Mademoiselle lifts her arms and we all rise in unison, recite the goodbye. Au revoir, Mademoiselle Lafarge. Au revoir, mes filles, she calls, as we place books and inkwells inside the tops of our desks. Gemma, could you stay for a moment, please? Her English accent is bracing as cold water after all that flowy French. Mademoiselle Lafarge is no more Parisian than I am. Felicity nearly trips in her mad rush to get out the door. Mademoiselle Felicity, there's no need to hurry. Pardon, Mademoiselle Lafarge. She glares at me. I've just remembered that I need to retrieve something important before my next class. When the room thins out to just the two of us, Mademoiselle Lafarge settles her bulk behind her desk. The desk is clear, except for a tintype of a handsome man in uniform, probably a brother or relative of some sort. After all, she is a mademoiselle, and older than 25. A spinster with no hopes of marrying now, otherwise what would she be doing here, teaching girls as a last resort? Mademoiselle Lafarge shakes her head. Your French is in need of much work, Mademoiselle Gemma. Surely you know this. You will have to work very hard to stay in this class with the other girls your age. If I don't see improvement, I will be forced to bounce you down to the lower classes. Yes, Mademoiselle. You can always ask the other girls for help if need be. Felicity's French is quite good. Yes, I say, swallowing hard, knowing full well that I would rather eat nails than ask for Felicity's help. The rest of the day passes slowly but uneventfully. There are elocution lessons, dancing and posture and Latin. There is music with Mr. Grunwald, a tiny, stooped Austrian man with a weary voice and a look of defeat stamped across his sagging face, every sigh saying that teaching us to play and sing is one step below being tortured slowly to death. We're all competent, if uninspiring, with our music, except for Anne. When she stands up to sing, a clear, sweet voice comes pouring out of her. It's lovely, if somewhat timid. With practice and a little more feeling, she could be quite good, actually. It's a shame that she won't ever get the chance. She's here to be trained to be of service, nothing more. When the music is over, she keeps her head down till she finds her seat again, and I wonder how many times each day she dies a little. "You have quite a nice voice," I whisper to her when she takes her seat. "You're just saying that to be kind," she says, biting a fingernail. But a blush works its way into her full, ruddy cheeks, and I know that it means everything to her to sing her song, if just for a little while. The week passes in a numbing parade of routine. Prayers, deportment, posture. Morning and night I enjoy the same social outcast status as Anne. In the evenings, the two of us sit by the fire in the great hall, the stillness broken only by the laughter coming from Felicity and her acolytes as they pointedly ignore us. By the week's end, I'm sure I've become invisible. But not to everyone. There is one message from Kartik. The night after I discover the diary, I find a letter from Father pinned to my bed with a small blade. The letter, rambling and sloppy, had hurt to read, and so I had stuffed it into my desk drawer, hidden away. Or so I thought. Seeing it on my bed, slashed, with the words, "You have been warned," scrawled across Father's signature, chilled me to the bone. The threat is clear. The only way to keep myself and my family safe is for me to shutter my mind to the visions. But I find I can't close off my mind without closing off the rest of me. Fear has me retreating inside myself, detached from everything, as useless as the scorched east wing upstairs.